I'm Erica Ensign.
And I'm Lisa Schmeiser.
And we welcome you back to the saga of rereading epics, in which we are rereading, reconsidering, and re-feeling Julian May's Saga of Pleistocene Exile and Galactic Milieu series. For this episode, we have reread the second book in the intervention interlude, The Metaconcert. So it's been a little while since we were here to talk about the first half of this. What are you thinking, Lisa?
It's so weird to have started this podcast at one point in human history and come back to it where we are now.
Yeah, a little behind the curtain, since this is not going to drop into the feed for a while. As we record this, it is the end of June of the year of the pandemic.
That's a great, this is like the worst zodiac ever, where you have the year of the pandemic, the year of the drought, the year of the... that said, what was really interesting is when we started the reread, I had a propulsive reading experience. You just kind of breathlessly moving from book to book to book. And then I came back to revisit it. And I feel like I got more insights again. Because I've learned to read the Erica Ensign way, where you're like, okay, how is Julian May tipping her hand at the very beginning of the book? And the other thing that I think actually influenced me a whole lot is with a little unrelated reading I was doing, I learned more about Rosemary Kennedy's lobotomy. And no, this is going someplace, I promise.
I'm on the edge of my seat. I want to know where.
Yeah. So she had a lobotomy, largely... And the thing, it's a terrible and heartbreaking story. She's the oldest daughter of, the oldest daughter of the Kennedy dynasty, as it were. And, Joseph Kennedy decided that, so her birth is very sad and very tragic for reasons we can get into for other things. But long story short, oxygen deprivation at birth, long-term cognitive and behavioral problems that her parents kept from everyone for years, because if the Catholic Church knew that she was, dealing with mental impairment, they wouldn't give her the sacrament of communion. And for super Catholics like Joe and Rose, obviously out of the question. So this poor kid spends her life trying to live up to her parents' impossible expectations, effectively being gaslit about the extent of her cognitive abilities. Her behavioral difficulties are glossed over as that's just not ladylike, so on and so forth. Joe gets her declared mentally retarded, and thanks to that sleight of hand, he goes and has her lobotomized without her mother's approval.
Whoa.
So this happens. The lobotomy is the exact opposite of a success, and they promptly pack her off to institutions until like the 1980s. Rose Kennedy doesn't see her own daughter for more than 20 years. Refuses to visit her. Like, first there's the question of she doesn't know where she is, and Joe puts out the lie that she's taking schooling with nuns and just doing a great job there. The reason I tell this story is because the family culture was so dedicated to the ideals of a certain type of success, the establishment of the family as power brokers of the elite, who had access to the highest corridors of power, who shaped a society in their own ideals, who had these rigorous internal codes that they upheld, choosing family over ethics in some cases. And it really gave me a fresh look at the dynamic of the Remillard family, especially Dennis, who I've always found really troubling in these books. I've grappled with him as a character and why May focuses on him so much and what we're supposed to take away from him. And after reading more about the Kennedy family and the tragedies with how Joe and Rose chose to parent their children and which ones they chose to sacrifice and which ones they channeled into different areas and what it all meant, I feel like I have a really great bead on the choices that Dennis made, especially relative to like his many siblings and relative to Victor and all of the rest of that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Because that's something I
always grapple
with.
That's a fascinating link. Yeah. I didn't know any of the real world stuff with the Kennedys, and wow, gosh, I've got some reading to do if I want to depress myself someday, apparently.
I think, well, I wouldn't call it a happy ending per se, but I will say that successive generations of the Kennedys, like, made an effort to bring Rosemary back into the family. Like, they pulled her, I wouldn't say they pulled, they had her visit from her assisted living situations so she could be at family events. They brought her out for the summer. She was loved and valued and taken care of by the people who would have been her nieces and nephews and their children as well. So there, I think that's ultimately hopeful in terms of her story. It's mm-hmm. still a huge tragedy. And, you know, and it's haunting in some ways because she didn't see her mother for 20 years. When her mother finally worked up the nerve or the whatever to go see her, Rosemary attacked her. Like, just apparently, like, she let out this primal scream and, like, her face twisted in grief and rage. And she ran towards this woman and began attacking her. Because, you know, even though she had the cognitive abilities of a toddler, she recognized that this was her mother and her mother hadn't been there for her.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, like, you realize there's that really primal parent-child thing. And again, like, the parent-child bond and the perversion of that bond is another huge theme in this book, too. So it's mm-hmm. just, you know, when I reread through those eyes, I'm like, oh my gosh, so many themes are suddenly apparent now.
Yeah, it's really interesting too how May really has her pet characters, her favorites. So, you know, mm-hmm. we kept talking about how it became the Mark show toward the end of the first four books. And here it's I mean, it's the Rogie show, but he's mm-hmm. our lens through which we see everything else. And it does seem to me like Dennis is very much sort of her pet character. And it's interesting mm-hmm. that we're seeing him through the lens of Rogie, who admits that, you know, Dennis is basically his son, the son that he yes. never had, the son that he wasn't able to have and therefore didn't get to have. And mm-hmm. how, you know, any choices that he makes, anything that he does is sort of just brushed aside, and he's really sort of like lifted on this pedestal, and we get very, very few moments where anything that Dennis does or any choices that Dennis makes have even any tiny kind of side eye from Rogie. Like can tell Rogie is upset about the fact that, you know, what happened to all of the other siblings and what Victor got away with, but he doesn't actually seem nearly as upset about it as I think he should be.
I think what it comes down to is he thinks of Dennis as an only child.
Yeah.
When the reality is Dennis is one of a really big group. And what we find out is, like, we found out in the last book that Victor effectively tortured all of his siblings into non-operancy. Mm-hmm. And it's something that Dennis and Rogie let happen. I'm not saying that there was a whole lot they could have perhaps done, but I guess what I am questioning is why didn't they put some sort of inhibitor block on Victor to keep him from doing that? Because you can certainly do that. They had figured that. Anyway, you find out in the last book that Victor, tortures his siblings into non-operancy. And then in this book, you find out that Victor is arranging for one of his siblings to be sold into an extremely brutal relationship where she's effectively going to be sex trafficked into a sadomasochistic relationship. She's expected to just take her beatings and go.
Yeah, the woman who was previously in that relationship died under mysterious circumstances. Yep.
Yes. Yeah. You know, and Victor's like, just don't kill my sister, and they're like, okay, fine. We think we can arrange that. And he makes the mistake. He tells Polly this is what's going to happen to her while she's under coercion, because this way, his theory is that it's going to implant in her brain as a compulsion that she has to do. What happens is while Polly's in the hold, she clocks everything. And when she comes out of it, she grabs her brother and she tells him what's going to happen. And she and her brother kill themselves rather than remain in that family. And they have no way out. It never occurs to them to ask Dennis for help because they simply know it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading that, like, way back when I first read the books and reading that and being like, oh, this is so epic and sprawling and sad. And I read it again and I'm just kind of furious on their behalves, because again, Dennis is never an option. This guy who's effectively, oh, I'm working for the meta-humanity and I'm working for the betterment of all of us, like, literally cannot be bothered to do anything about the siblings who have been terrorized by Victor from babyhood. And this is something I really struggle with, because we're supposed to see him as this figure who, like, is ideal and principled and works tirelessly and makes the world a better place. And he can't even make his family a better place.
Nope. And the idea, too, that his choice to effectively ignore the rest of his family and let what happens is, like, that choice and that decision to just be completely pacifistic and peaceful directly leads to the very end of the book, the intervention. Yeah. And like the implication is that if he had taken action against Victor and helped out, you know, these half dozen of his family members, that perhaps the world would not have been pure enough to bring down the benevolent, you know, aliens that are going to help lift humanity out of the doldrums that they are in. Yeah. So, you know, it's one of those things where we're effectively, we've traded this entire family for the glory of the earth. And that's one of those things where in fiction, that is a choice that different authors seem to fall on different sides of. And it seems like May here is like, well, you know, they were necessary casualties for the greater good.
I feel like this is actually something, because this goes along with a whole lot of angels dancing on the heads of pins. It's the type of ethical question that you get put to in CCD or any sort of religious instruction you have in some strains of Christianity or in Catholicism. This is exactly the type of stuff that you end up talking about with your teacher when you're 13. And your teacher is like, well, murder is a sin, but if someone's going to murder 10 people, do you murder them to prevent the murder of 10 people and have that sin on your soul? Or do you let them go ahead and bear that sin and keep them And like, this is the type of discussion you have. And what Julian May has effectively done is like thought through her answers and written a book. Thing is like it's really interesting fiction, but she never really goes into the damage that these choices make. Like it's arguing in bad faith, because we don't ever get to understand what it's like to grow up if you're not Dennis or Victor. We don't see that. We don't get to see how painful or fearful it might be if you're somebody who runs afoul of Kieran O'Connor and you're not a metapsychic. You know, and I think to be able to argue, oh, this is, well, you can't get to a meta concert omelet without breaking a few sibling eggs. you know, I feel like it's almost a disingenuous argument, and she's the author. She gets to make the turn. She gets to draw the boundaries around her story, and she gets to tell you what she tells you. I don't know, and I can't figure out if it's deliberate that we get the perspective of a doting father and his only child, and these other people he's really incidental, or if this is you and I taking that reading and it's something that May had gone through subconsciously, because what we were supposed to be focusing on instead is how fantastic Dennis is for having principles in the first place.
Right. Well, speaking of doting fathers and their only children, you mentioned Kieran O'Connor a moment ago, that's another display of fatherhood and wow. She's really good at writing the dark side, the dark stuff. Like as nice and warm and fuzzy as I feel when I'm reading Rogi talking about Dennis or any of the other things that he is less grumpy about, it's nothing compared to the visceral reactions I get in like the chapters when we have the murder suicide of poor Dennis's siblings or any of the chapters with Kieran O'Connor. Like starting from, you know, in our previous episode, we talked about, you know, his experiences with his mother kind of like psychically dragging him down into her painful nonsense. And here he's just like bringing that right along.
So what I thought was interesting, and I hadn't made the connection years ago when I first read this, and had now, is you have Kieran and you have Shannon, who is his daughter and his most cherished pawn, who tries not to be. And what I found interesting and tragic and infuriating is there's a little bit of an echo of Felice's storyline. Because remember, there's the theory may floats that Felice is the monster she is for two reasons. One, she's a lesbian. And two, she was tortured. She was abused as a child. And so that permanently broke her psyche and she can't. And over the course of the books, it's like, Felice, you don't count as a person unless and until we can fix your psyche. And when she rejects the fixing, then she's living in a state of sin, blah, blah, blah. It all comes back to May's religious approach. And in this, Shannon is abused the same way that Kieran, that same way that Felice was. And, you know, because Kieran violates her trust. Like, she remembers all of it, apparently. Like, that's I actually have that line highlighted in the book, Shannon remembered. Yeah.
And even before that, you know, she grows up in a household that is, you know, directly tied to the mafia. Her mother is killed specifically because of his actions. So, you know, she's living a really troubled life to start with. And, you know, the first scene that we see her in, she's swimming in a pool with her wrists slit open and letting the blood flow around and singing weird poetry. And then after that, that's when he violates her both physically and mentally. It's like, what an introduction to this character. So I found myself rooting for her to be able to take him down and get back at him. And sadly, she sort of goes in the Felice direction, where she doesn't quite become the hero that I feel like she could have, or maybe not should have, but could have been. She is ruined.
Well, she turns into Mercy.
Oh my God, she does.
She starts as Felice and she turns into Mercy, because by the end of it, she's, you know, betraying one faction by aligning with another. And then she's obliterated with the same type of sucking out of the metapsychic energies that led to Mercy being turned into ash. It's uncanny.
Yeah, Mercy was also, really almost always described in reflection of the men that she was around. And it's kind of the same thing with Shannon, because she's the daughter of Kieran. And then we think maybe she's going to get it together and be her own thing. But no, she just goes about trying to use Gerard Tremblay and Victor. And
Victor.
In the end, Victor is the one that takes her down.
Like, her dad is basically Culliket the Interrogator. And Victor is basically, I'd say he's, I wouldn't say he's Nodan one hand, because Nodan was frankly incompetent and not crafty, but he's like a less smart version of Aiken Drum. Like, he's an Aiken Drum who never had the realization that humanity was necessary to unlock your power. And like, it's just so weird that I found it very striking that those themes resonate. And I don't know if this is just because you and I have had the benefit of reading these books back to back to back to back to back and being able to talk about them and see these things resonate in a way that perhaps readers who read them year by year and had other things sloshing around their brain pan might not have. But when I read them this time, I kept thinking, she has some wells that she returns to over and over again. Like, she really reserves a deep and persistent moral outrage for anybody who abuses children. But at the same time, she's hard on the victims in a way. Like, Shannon is given no quarter, narratively speaking. They never present her as anybody who has any redeeming qualities.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, I thought they were going to, like, at the start. She really seemed like, at first, the idea of just her wanting to take her father down was going to end up somewhere good, because before he does the bonding technique on her, she's actually saying, I'm going to leave this life. I don't think that your idea about metapsychics is correct. I think those people over in New Hampshire or wherever, like, they've got the right idea. I want to go and work with them and see if we can make the world a better place. So you get this moment where there's like this glimpse of what she could have been if Kieran had not stopped her. And, you know, he's not able to entirely take over her mind, because, you know, she remembers. Oh, she makes me shudder every time. So she remembers. So at first I'm thinking, okay, she's going to be able to take him down. And maybe, and even though I'd read this before, it's been a long time. I didn't exactly remember how her story turned out.
Yeah.
Until like midway through the book. And then I was like, oh, right, this. So for a moment...
Sorry, just the over this. Yep. Yeah.
For a moment, I'm thinking she's gonna be a hero. She's gonna take him down and be this hero that helps move the world closer toward that great meta concert that brings down the intervention. And no, because he's bound her deeply enough that he can, that, you know, she does love him with this kind of disgusting love-hate relationship. Mm-hmm. And especially whenever she's in the room with him, she literally can't think for herself or on her own. And mm-hmm. I was even kind of rooting for her to take him down in the bad way and, like, just, you know, get together with Victor and just at least overthrow Kieran. And at the end, when you find out that he always knew about her double shielding and he could always see into her secret mind, that was like a gut punch to me. I was like, damn. Ugh.
Well, what? It's just so cruel. She gets killed that way, and then she gets killed, tortured to death by Victor, too.
Yep.
And I don't know if there's any other character who gets obliterated as thoroughly as poor Shannon does. Mm-hmm. And the thing I grapple with is you know, by the universe, by the moral laws of the universe that Julian May has set up, there's the idea that people's lives have value and their characters are redeemed if, you know, they cleave to some sort of ethos and they exercise their free will towards a set of principles that May embraces. Because she cuts a lot of slack to a lot of these metapsychics, you know, some of whom have actually killed people.
Rogi especially. Like,
yes!
He's all over the place. And, like, it's fine because it's Rogi and they need him.
But this poor girl she can't control who she's born to. And she's used and abused by her father and the men that her father trades her off to. And, like, May cuts off any and all lines of escape for her, the same way that Victor cut off any and all lines of escape and support for his siblings. And I don't understand how May can square that in her moral universe. And I also don't understand why there isn't more attention put on the prices that other people pay for situations they're completely helpless to either prevent or escape.
Or is that somehow supposed to be the point? That like, this is our world and it's kind of awful. I mean, when you think about how Shannon was killed psychically by, you know, Victor, like a vampire sucking the energy out of the different chakra, like, of energy, and that in itself would be bad enough, but because we had that earlier chapter where we learn about Rogi meeting Ume and how they have this, like, amazing multiple hour intercourse experience that's,
thanks,
you know,
to the same thing. Yeah, exactly. It's a perversion of the energies.
Yeah, the other side. So you get the ecstasy side of it first, and you learn about how, you know, you have this beautiful energy in you, and when it entwines with somebody else, you are just transported and taken to, you know, it's a completely wonderful experience that is very, you know, rare and beautiful. And then we learn very late in the book that there is a complete flip side to this. And, you know, mm-hmm. Shannon is so sort of matter of fact about, you know, you're going to kill me and you're not going to make it quick. And, like, at least she doesn't go into detail, like, during the murder. We basically just see the very, very end of it, because, like, we get a lot of description of the ecstasy side of it. If we had mm-hmm. to read that much description about the agony side of it, and like, she was in there for hours being killed, you know, and one of the lines is, like, and then he stopped her heart
for the first time. It's a horrifying line, because I kept thinking the revivals must be just worse than having your heart stopped. Mm-hmm. Because when you have your heart stop, at least it's a release. But to be brought back from that must just be terrible.
Yep.
And, you know, that's what Victor wants, which is just, mm-hmm. I mean, he's a great monster.
Yes.
And she's playing on such a classic theme in literature, which is brother versus brother, because there's all these works where the central agony somebody has is, we came from the same people. How can we be so completely different? How can we want such different things? Why are we in opposition to each other? But the thing is, Victor's just so cartoonish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did we, like, I'm trying to think throughout the first four books, we had a lot of political interplay and different factions mm-hmm. fighting against each other. But we never really had like a villainous villain because we got perspective, even from the yes. people that we were rooting against. Like we understood their mm-hmm. motivations, and none of them really seemed as, like you said, cartoony and mustache twirly. Actually, mustache twirly is not right because that sounds too funny. Like this is darker yeah. than that.
It's awful.
I think this is like she takes this opportunity. You know, we're not in the it's elves and gnomes past anymore. Mm-hmm. Now we're in the present, and the present is dirty and grim and awful. So let's give you this actual villain. And she goes hard.
Yes. The thing is like with Sharn and Ifa, they had a son. They loved their son. They saw mm-hmm. it as their duty and their responsibility to uphold their cultural legacy and pass that along to their son. And with the Tenu, it was the same way. Where they had been indoctrinated that this cultural legacy is the best and brightest of us. And we left our home planet for this legacy. So this is what we have to uphold. And even if you don't sympathize with those arguments, like these people have a code and they operate by it. Victor has no code other than just this rapacious, amoral power. Delight in other people suffering. Mm-hmm. Like the power is a nice side effect, but what he really, really loves is how other people suffer. Yep. And it's just so interesting that he pairs off with Kieran, who has given his life over to the Black Mother and pain and suffering. And so you've got like that what is initially presented as like a mutual relationship and ultimately separates, where Kieran is like, eh, he's going to kill me. It's fine.
You don't even need to bother. I'm gone anyway.
Yeah. But you know, maybe Victor's supposed to stand for the unstructured void, or how terrible we are if we don't develop a moral code and stick to it. Whereas Dennis is nothing but a walking, you know, a walking tautology. But in this, like you said, you don't get a whole lot of other perspectives. The closest you come is when someone is spying on Victor one book back, and they're like, he has a lot of nightmares with monsters in them, and his face is the monster in every one. Mm-hmm. And that is like the closest you get to anything other than this.
Like they continually,
force of something beyond nature.
As the book goes on, he is repeatedly described as, you know, somebody who was formerly human or who is mm-hmm. is inhuman. So like his humanity has left somewhere along the line in this book. Like, yeah, you had that. You're right. We did have that glimpse in the mm-hmm. previous book, sort of giving us this idea that Don taking over mm-hmm. his quote unquote mental training.
Yeah.
And not being being such a jealous person, like, you know, planted the seed and it grew up into this. So we have, you know, that's another example of the father-son relationship, which is really toxic and mm-hmm. and not great. And then at the end of this, when the ghost is able to tell Rogi, no, I didn't help you when Victor didn't kill you at the hotel, because Victor, like, pathetically did actually want you to possibly somehow train him and teach him the way that you did with Dennis, which, like, you know, I feel like at this point May had gone too far in describing him as a monster for me to have any kind of sympathy at that point. Yeah. Like I was like, yeah, you're right, it is pathetic, and I just don't care.
I don't buy it. Mm-hmm. Well, because at some point I could see if you had laid groundwork earlier where Don is, you know, cruelly, psychically nudging Victor along a specific path and doing his best to confound a relationship between Rogi and Victor. And Victor sees the Rogi-Dennis relationship and it's like, why can't I have that? Why do I have to have this? Why can't Rogi rescue me? Like, if we had seen anything like that, yeah. I would have bought this, oh, the unconscious Oedipal motivation thing going on. So I don't get it. I do find it really fascinating that, again, it always comes back to, like, weird sibling dynamics, because you find out that the reason Rogi has such great mental screens is because he kept Don out from the womb on. And all Don wanted was to be let in. And so there's, like, all sorts of, there's all these things, these iterations that it comes down to, where the idea is that if one person has an ungoverned hunger, that somehow makes them weak and more susceptible to doing terrible things to people. And there are seems to be a real aversion in May's writing to the idea that appetites are also a source of pleasure.
Yes. Yeah, I'm getting that. Like, if you are, if you're Dennis, you're good because you don't, like, even his marriage was basically an arranged, it was self-arranged, but it was an arranged marriage that ended up working out really, really great because he did it for the right reasons. He did it for the good of society. He did it for the good of passing on strong genes so we'd have good stock of metapsychics going down the road. And then, of course, they did manage to fall in love of a sort and became, you know, great partners and, you know, good
great
for him.
Research partners. They had rules that they followed. Like, there's a whole thing about how they treated each other with exaggerated politesse, and they had rules and structures for how their marriage would go. And I kept thinking, oh, that's the Julian May positing that perhaps rules and structures are what's most beneficial when you completely subjugate your own wants and desires for something abstract. Huh.
Yep.
Like, wonder where that theme has come from.
And I mean, no shade if that's the way that you run your marriage and it works for you. Yeah. Great. I just feel like it's a statement here.
Well, it's a statement because she's really suspicious of appetite. She's suspicious of wants, and she doesn't find them worthy or valuable. Like, and I get that it's part of her larger worldview where you're supposed to find purpose and a deeper sense of joy and contentment from turning your life and your energies over to something greater than yourself. And again, this is a value that you get taught in some sorts of religious upbringing. And this book really does seem to reflect a lot of a very specific catechism. Mm-hmm. She just stacks the deck so thoroughly. And I guess when I was a teenager, I'm like, oh, this is all very interesting. And oh, these ideas are worth chewing on. And I actually like fell into a bunch of philosophical wormholes. But like now I keep thinking, you're stacking the deck. The arguments you're making don't give a lot of grace to anybody. And if you have to stack a deck for your argument that hard, how good is your argument to begin with? Why isn't it more robust? Why can't it stand up against something else?
Just pounding that table.
I am. I got all worked up for a minute there.
I think part of this is why I just really still love Rogi as a character, because he's the one who has this get out of jail free card. And I think it's in part because she needs him to be the structure for these two novels. She needs him to be the window through which we see it all. He witnesses these things and tells us about them. And if he was, you know, one of them, if he was like Dennis, there's no way that he would have this, the particular view that he does. So she has to have a character who is sort of, you know, an audience point of view character, really, who
he's
is
basically
like
that. He's basically the Russian monk from the last.
Yeah.
Which she's got that. And that's kind of an archetype in fiction, too. Like, that's been there since the Canterbury Tales. And I love it. I love Rogi as a character. And I don't ever stop. And this book just reinforced that he's like also a really great uncle to the kids.
Yes.
He's this
cranky old fellow who doesn't necessarily need to subscribe to the views that the other people who succeed in the books subscribe to, because his purpose is a different purpose. He's not just a window to see everything else. He is subtly pushing things along with the help of the ghost, who we now know who that is. My mind was completely blown at the end of this book the first time I read it. My God. But yeah, so with Mark's help, he's helping move the pieces on the chessboard. So again, I feel like that's another like get out of jail free card. He gets to stand aside from all of the needs that the other characters have, because he's got to be the mover and the shaker behind the scenes.
Yeah. He's the mover and the shaker who never gets credit.
Until these books come out, and
A certain amount of humility, and he also doesn't even get the pride of dignity or the pride. I think all the Remillards love him, and I think they depend on him in a way they wouldn't anybody else. And no spoilers, this certainly comes up in the next three books, where all of these people who are otherwise galactic movers and shakers would be nobody or they wouldn't be able to keep their sanity together if they didn't lean on him in their hour of need, and he comes through. Mm-hmm. So I love that May loves him.
Yeah.
And I love him as a character, and I love that he's cranky and flawed and things like that. I just wish he wasn't the only example of affectionate and well-rounded humanity in the book.
Yes. Yeah. The only other characters that we get that strike me as sort of affectionate and well-rounded are not like super well-rounded, because we only see them briefly, but are some of the aliens, like the Poltroians who land on Earth and go wander off and watch a bunch of dog sledding and then, you know, discover that the Sons of Earth are making a move. But like they are, like, I would hang out with those folks. Mm-hmm. And like Rogi's probably the only other person that I would in these books that I would actually want to like hang out with and chill with. And they're in literally one short chapter.
I do enjoy the child Severin out of all of Dennis and Lucille's children. Like, Severin is my favorite.
He is very cute. I mean, like they don't do a whole lot at this point, but his just precociousness
and his pugnacity. Mm-hmm. I love that he's all, they're all, no, no, we have to be high-minded and float above it. And he's like, why? No.
Let him take me on.
Yeah, exactly.
They better not come for me, I think that's what he said.
Like this little 10-year-old firecracker. I love him. And I like him as an adult later, too.
He strikes me as, like, right now, like a mini Rogi in a way, because he's just, like, kind of, like, pushing against what everybody else is saying and or ignoring it. And then he also is the one who actually makes mental contact with Rogi to try to, like, help him, you know, duck. Don't get hit with the bullets, and now here you have to go up the mountain, and you know they lose contact pretty fast. But for those few moments, I was just like, okay, this is a cool bond that I'm appreciating.
And like the thing is the fact that Rogi has that bond with Dennis's kids. Again, I get that it's basically a de facto grandpa bond, even though it's called Uncle Rogi's. But it just makes me so much sadder for all of the Remillard kids that Victor got to first, because
they could have had that.
And, you know, Victor's in action in the face of what his brother did. Not Victor's in action. Dennis is in action in the face of what Victor did. Like, I always struggle with it. Like, I get that for Dennis, perhaps he made the calculus that I can do more good for more people with the work that I do at Dartmouth and staying clear and just coming around for holidays. Perhaps that's the calculus he made, but it's just,
well, I mean, I think,
what do you say about somebody who lets that many bad things happen, like in his own house, as it were?
I think, I mean, maybe it's because he makes the decision when he's so young. And while he is very, you know, he's smart for a kid, but he comes to the idea of being a pacifist real early, early. And I think because he doesn't really have the imagination that you develop as an older person, having lived more life, I think he, especially considering like his relationship with his brother, I think he honestly believes that the only way that he is going to be able to intervene and help his other siblings is by directly confronting Victor, and that would lead to violence, and violence is something that he is absolutely abhors and has sworn off. So if he were to do anything, he would just end up dead, and his family would end up in the same situation and possibly worse, because he wouldn't even be able to help subtly from the side. So he does this mental calculus as a child, basically, and never comes to any other kind of realization that maybe there's another way he could tackle it from, you know, come at it from the side. So I think he just has that in his mind and then goes on and grows up. It's like, you know, when you go off to college for the first time, and you kind of just forget about home for a while, and you don't, like, you know, you're living your own life, and that old life is behind you. And then by the time that I think he has more emotionally matured later on, as he's aged, I don't think that anything even like occurs to him that there could be a different way or could have been a different way. Or maybe he's just like, there's a deep part of him that is guilty for having let that happen all that time. And he doesn't want to reassess and see if there's a different way to handle it. Because if there is a different way to handle it, that means there was a different way to handle it before, and he could have taken care of it previously. And he's not able to face that inside himself.
That's, you've basically convinced me. I've come around. Yes, no, it's, and you did so, and it was such a humane and compassionate thing, because you point out that when you're a child, even when you're gifted and prodigiously so, you still have a child's feelings. You don't have a broad base of experience. Yeah, so yeah, I'm coming around, because I'm being harsh on somebody who made a lot of survival-based decisions at a young age and then didn't have a chance to revisit them. And by the time he did, there wasn't a lot left to do.
Because one thing May never does is pretend that all of these metas that are very powerful are like perfect human beings. They are definitely,
I love that.
They are definitely all flawed. They all have their own personalities and they are all flawed in their own ways. And I think, you know, one of the few flaws that we have just picked at here with Dennis is perhaps like a deep seated guilt that he wasn't able to help his family, but he's not able to even really face it. I kind of wish that had been, you know, not so much subtext, that I didn't have to kind of dig so far to get to that. If that would have been addressed a little bit more obviously, I probably would be a little bit happier about it. But I do think that there's enough in the text there to make it so that, like, yes, it's headcanon, but it's not like really far down the road headcanon.
No. It's like I said, you made a great argument. You pulled me back around and all right. I have to stand by what I said about Dennis earlier, because I said it and I meant it at the time. I was wrong.
Well, welcome to this side of the couch.
Exactly. Yes. Here we go. Yeah. It's, well, I think there are so many ethical questions that come up with this type of stuff. And I appreciate that May brings them up and lets you see what happened. But at the same time, she's so unforgiving with some of her characters and some of the outcomes. It's a book that's almost terrifying with how few opportunities for a happy ending there are.
Yep. It's and it also has those moments where it's just like, I feel like it hasn't aged as well as I would like in terms of her view. Once again, same as in the previous books, of of gender essentialism. And, you know, like there's that really, really early on, we get descriptions of creativity, really at the beginning. Let me see. The font of here we go.
I think you and I may have both the same quote.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we have Ume says, "The font of creativity lies within all human souls. In women, it is very often never channeled to the conscious level, but rather fruits instinctively in childbearing and maternal nurture. A very few men are also creative nurturers, but most, and certain women, must guide their creativity deliberately into the exterior reality by intellectual action. They must build work." And then they go on to talk about how dangerous it is if you don't channel that creativity into something else. And I'm thinking, what now? Because I have no children and I'm not like super maternal. And so I guess what it boils down to is I am one of those certain women who have to do it the other way.
So this is part of, I highlighted this too, because I was like, there's something to be said for creativity. It is a great way to channel energy. It's a great way also to, I would argue, transcend yourself and work on something bigger than yourself. And so the problem I have, there are two problems I have, and one of them is, one, she effectively argues that most women don't need to do this. So there's that. And then two, she never seems open to the possibility that maybe you can do this and still be creative in another way. And I don't know if this is part of her having grown up in a very specific time and place where there wasn't a lot of support for women doing both, where women could comfortably push back and say, no, I think if I'm writing books, it's okay for you to pick up the kids from school or something like that. Where if you wanted to do it, it was like, oh, you get to have an author career on top of raising your kids, Shirley Jackson. So maybe it's a generational relic, or it's a socialization relic that comes through. But, you know, I remember reading this as a younger woman and being really discouraged by the idea that if you are a creative woman, you know, why don't you just go ahead and channel those energies into childbearing and child rearing? Mm-hmm. This is a way you can die into yourself and be selfless by completely obliterating your personhood in the service of procreation. so there's that going on. And Also, whenever I read anything like this, I'm reminded of the way that Anne McCaffrey kind of splits the difference in her books, where, you know, oh, if women want to have a career riding dragons, that's why there's fostering.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, where I'm like, at least she acknowledges there's labor and it's specialized. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a lot of gender essentialism in this. And she really does seem to come down hard on women who step outside the lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about this with Mercy, and I think it comes back to it with Shannon, too, where Shannon tries to step outside the lines.
Mm-hmm. And Sunny, too, because when you think about it, like, you know, you were talking about how she comes down on hard on women, and she also doesn't like, you know, people's desires and needs and stuff. And Sunny genuinely loves Don. Like, yeah. You know, it's made really clear in the previous book that she loves him, and she wants to just, you know... She chooses him over Rogi because that's the person that she loves and that's what her desire is. And wow, like, you know, she's not treated as badly as Shannon, but she's also treated really poorly because, you know, Don's screwing with her head as well. Yeah. And she just has to watch this happen to all of her kids. And she's not stupid. So, like, she understands what's going on and just retreats deeper and deeper into her own self and into her own psyche to sort of just try to deny what is happening in front of her. And it just gets worse and worse.
Yeah. It's just the whole... Ugh. There's that. There's the... woman Elaine, which was the last book, but it's kind of a pattern where, and the other thing I'd point out in this book is that poor Lucille has that breakup with Bill, which happens because they start subliminally planting messages that, oh, she's a terrifying monster and she's destructive. Remember, like, her energies and her psychic stuff manifests as her setting things on fire because she's furious. And
honestly, you know, a distressing amount of that wasn't even like subconscious. It was literally just Rogi saying, this is the way that it is. This is what it's like to be a meta human. Do you actually want to be married to that? And he thinks about it and decides no.
Yeah, and Lucille gets no say. Well, it's Lucille gets almost no say. She's maneuvered into place to be a broodmare to the father of the metapsychic establishment. Mm-hmm. And it's just, there's a lot of complicated feelings about parenthood that May was working through. I don't know. But it again comes down to that. I don't necessarily say anymore that's a shocking lack of empathy. It comes down to not giving full personhood to the players in the drama if they're not one of a small handful of people who are meant to play a really clear role, like the moral clarity or the flawed, loving avatar of humanity we're supposed to identify with, or the howling void with human skin or what have you. So it's tough. It's tough to grapple with. But yeah, I highlighted that and I was like, ooh, that's not good. And it's a passage I have a lot of trouble with.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That was why I not only highlighted it, like wrote it in my notes. It's like, like I'm putting a bookmark here on my old paperback book so that I can find this again.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of echoes of Achan and Mercy, too, because one of the things that Mercy argues is that, you know, she's the grandmaster of creation.
Right.
And so her power is life-giving and creative, and it forms things, and it's beautiful. And the trade-off we saw in those books is that she's a terrible mother. Like, utterly indifferent, doesn't prioritize the well-being of her child. By the metric that Ume's put forth, you know, Mercy has perverted or redirected her font of creativity that way. Mercy has effectively given up rights to creativity when she gives up the nurturing thing. And then we see that happen again with Shannon, because she has her baby, Laura. And all that we really find out is that Gerald knows that Laura is not his, but he's going to raise her anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's it. You know, there's never a moment when Shannon is trying to maneuver into her endgame. There's never a moment where she worries about Laura's future. There's never a moment where she regrets that she's not going to see Laura grow up. There's never a moment where she thinks, I'm leaving her motherless the same way I was left motherless. Like, that never comes up, despite the fact that her mother died at about the same when she was about the same age that her own daughter is.
Whoa. I put that together, and that's totally, totally the same. Man.
Yes. So it's another Mercy Limbaugh parallel where Shannon gives up her font of creative, perverts her font of creativity, as it were. So punish her.
Yep. Oh, and she gets the big punishment.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Disproportionate to a lot of their characters. And I don't like it. No. You know, and like I said, you know, admittedly, I have a problem with this passage because I am somebody who, you know, works as a creative professional, and I have to figure out, or rather, I should say, it's my joyful privilege to figure out how to do that while also, you know, nurturing and raising somebody who I think hung the moon and the stars. I really don't like when it's set up as an either or proposition. And I also think it's dehumanizing to any women who have chosen differently and been like, I don't need one to have the other. Mm-hmm. Like, I just think that's hogwash. So I'm having a lot of, yeah. I'm having a hard time separating my reaction from this passage, mm-hmm. which is effectively like May tipping her hand on how everything's going to end.
Because you know, I mean, it's truly amazing that you are able to create a lovely child, and you're also able to be creative in the real world, like the non-household world. Well, everything's a household world right now, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, at some point, someone's going to turn me into ash. I've seen how this goes.
Oh my God. You call me and I will be there and I will kick their ass.
Erica, help! There's a guy in a golden suit. He's because she does the whole thing where, oh, destruction is pleasure too, dark and addictive and non-intellectual. But for the destroyer, however, process is all. He must continue lest the darkness catch up with him. And he must come at the end to the hell he has deliberately prepared for himself. And this is May effectively like, yeah, this is how it's going to end for Kieran.
Oh my God. And Victor, really, because he ends up trapped in his own head for 27 years with no ability to reach out metapsychically or otherwise. Ugh. And just has to live with what he's become. And, you know, wow, that's
yeah. Nice. See, I sort of wish they had returned a little bit to how he dreams or given us another mm-hmm. glimpse, because I'd love to know if, like, I would like a little more texture to Victor being shut in his head. Mm-hmm. You know, if the idea is that, oh, it's torture because he has no one else left to devour and he feels disempowered, or if you're like, well, it's torture because he's living with all of the monsters of himself. Mm-hmm. You don't get that. And it'd be kind of gratifying to have that, narratively speaking.
Yeah, that section was very perfunctory. Like, it was like two sentences and that's all you get.
Yep. Oh, and then Victor is Victor is zapped inside his own head. The end.
Yep. Right. Yeah. I mean, honestly, the entire book is pretty perfunctory at the end, because mm-hmm. you know it's this is the middle section, and that is made very clear even in this book before the others come out, that you know Rogi says at the end, you know, I finished that section, and it really is a bit of a cliffhanger because you've got all of these spaceships shining in the air over the chalet in Mount Washington, mm-hmm. and that's the beginning of the intervention and
Deus Ex Machina, like the most literal you can have.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's definitely like there's a lot. I felt like it picked up speed kind of toward the end. There was mm-hmm. I took a note here. So when we have the moment where we find out that Rogi is the one who is planning the last metapsychic congress, or what might mm-hmm. possibly be the last one because things are going so poorly, mm-hmm. because it's at the Mount Washington Hotel where he used to work, and like Rogi meets the ghost up on the mountain, and Rogi is told to have the final dinner up at the chalet, and you know, to tell Dennis to incite the meta concert with all of them, you know, asking the universe for help if necessary, have him deep scan the Great Carbuncle, which then we find out nothing about in this book at all.
No, it just
flashes. But anyway, so like that was the point at the end of that chapter. That mm-hmm. was when like it was the I don't want to stop reading moment, and just like before, I planned out exactly how many pages I had to read every day to read this over the space of like about 2 weeks so that I wouldn't forget about it and I wouldn't like read it all at once, but I would have time to read everything. So I was very good, but I wanted to just keep turning pages and reading and reading and get to the end of it, because I feel like each section gets like shorter and shorter. Like the chapters themselves have lots of short sections in them, as opposed to earlier in the book where they are somewhat chapters that are just kind of longer with one or fewer sections in them. So there's a lot of bouncing around at the end, and it just like it picks up speed and it gets really frenetic until the end, and then it's just like boom, it's done.
Boom, done. Yep. Pete LaPlace. Yeah.
Exactly. And then that was not even clear either, because he's asked is every time we saw Pete LaPlace in the books, was that Mark? Every time?
Like, yeah, it's not quite clear.
Uh-huh. So
like, does he just kind of casually pick up his body when he feels like it?
And how does that work? Because what if Victor is staying at Pete LaPlace's house, you know, and like he needs Pete helping him out for like 3 weeks straight, and there's a galactic, you know, emergency on the other side of the universe? Like maybe he's just a really great scheduler and multitasker. I don't know.
It's what I wonder is if Pete is a legitimate person who runs around and does this thing, and Mark just kind of hops into his body and possesses it from time to time.
That would make so much more sense, but that's not quite how it was worded. So I was confused.
No. And, I bookmarked the page where it's implied that Rogi is the one that, traps Victor inside his head. And, the thing that comes up, it happens right as intervention happens, or right as the meta concert happens, because they both get lifted off their feet by this quote unquote uncanny sense of warm benevolence, a beckoning bright calmness. Mm-hmm. And Victor was feeling it too. And then May says, the expression on his face was one of a furious, perplexed child. Poor Victor. Something seemed to urge me to reach out to him to show him where help lay, but I was too old and weary and I resisted. And, I find this passage almost unbearably poignant now for a couple of reasons. One, because it shows that Rogi's fear is the biggest thing that holds him back from being truly great. Like, he resists redaction, he resists joining into meta concert, he resists unity because he's got this fear that he won't let go of, and it's a fear he's had ever since the womb. And it's part of what makes him really human. But what it implies is there's this moment, just this one moment, where it could have been so different for Victor if Rogi had reached out. But once again, Rogi can't. Mm-hmm. And then it turns into Victor going, okay, that time's over. Time to kill you. And Rogi's all, no, zap. And then Pete LaPlace shows up and he's all right, let's see what happens.
Lots of little moments in these books where things could go a different way, but then they don't.
Mm-hmm. No, and maybe that's supposed to be part of it too, the idea that your life is really out of your control and foreordained. I mean, it even comes up in like the epilogue where Mark says, or I should say that the family ghost who is revealed to be Mark, which like the first time I read that as a kid, I'm like, oh no, I was like, how did that happen? But what he says in this one is, my actions, though quite freely willed, were demonstrably preordained in the larger reality, which is a mystery. And I'm like, so this is where we're going with the cosmic script. Is that it? So
I guess.
Yeah,
it was. I read that section and I was just like, that's a lot of words. I'm just going to keep going. That's just a lot of words.
No, it's basically Mark saying, oh, this, all of this has been foreordained. And the idea is that your free will is merely like it's merely the atom vibrating to the left or the right within the larger lattice work that's in which it's enmeshed. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Sure. All right. Well, anything else you want to cover before we put this one to bed?
No. This was, I want to say, like the rare middle or bridge installment, which you don't find yourself going, this is just moves from point A to point B. Like, I feel like it does a great job of establishing a lot of groundwork that you do not realize it's establishing until much later in the series. And it's a very satisfying read because it feels oddly relevant to our times in terms of arguing over what we value and why we value it. So,
yeah, know, for all of my... for all of my like complaints and niggles and picking at it and stuff, because, you know, that's what a podcast is for. Like, I really still enjoyed both of these books. Like, this was I zipped through them much faster than I did any of the earlier ones and probably any of the later ones. So I very much enjoyed revisiting these. And, you know, speaking of being relevant to today, there was one more passage that that I highlighted simply because, you know, as we said, we are recording this in the time of the pandemic when we haven't left our homes very much lately. And, you know, watching the world and specifically America deal with a disaster of this this category. Let's see. It starts with talking about Americans. This ostrich attitude, but tendency to discount the possibility of disaster until it smacks you in the teeth, was probably quintessentially American. Even in the worst of times, we were a people who hoped for the best and believed that good intentions covered a multitude of sins. Because we were a young nation, because we skimmed the cream of the planetary mind, and because our land was on arguably the richest and most fortunate on Earth, Americans had the arrogance of the golden an adolescent upon whom fate smiles. We thought we were invincible as well as stronger and smarter than everyone else. And I read that passage and I laughed and I laughed.
So what's really funny is what I had highlighted way back was we thought we were invincible as well as stronger and smarter than everyone else. We suffered a periodic comeuppance but bounced back as triumphalistic as ever. And the note I had was such a 20th century perspective.
Too funny.
It resonated with me too. And yeah, it's perfect for our times.
All right. Well, we will do just a very, very brief looking ahead. So if you are reading these books for the first time and don't want to be spoiled about what is coming any more than the, you know, family history chart at the back of these books spoils you for, then please disembark at this point. Please leave the chalet by whatever means you can at this point. And we will continue here in spoiler space. So as I said before, I really don't remember a whole lot about... Okay, I really remember next to nothing about the books that are coming. The only thing, as I've said before, that I remember is Rogi up in like the Canadian wilds being very cold and meeting Bigfoot. Like that is it. But I have gotten more hints in this book, bits and pieces to what is coming. Was there anything in this volume that put you in mind of what is in our future?
Not really. I mean, what I found was interesting was I kept finding themes that had resonated from the Pliocene exile into this book. Time is a flat circle. It all loops around. But in terms of, because I did start reading Jack the Bodiless, and I haven't found a whole lot that bridges from A to B just yet. Maybe that will change when I go back and review Jack the Bodiless before the next podcast again and say, oh my gosh, based on the conversation we had, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is just like putting some of it's furniture moving here, putting the people into place that we know are going to have babies, and those babies are going to be the movers and shakers in the following books.
Yeah. And I think, and this is a theme that I think echoes across all of the books, is the narrative engine that seems to be the primal sin that creates generations upon generations of suffering and agony is always the violation of the parent-child bond. And you see, like, you know, that engine, I think, gets a little bit more oil in the gears, as it were, because there is such an emphasis placed on how many kids the Remillard kids have been pumping out. And so I think you see that get laid down just a little bit.
Because, that's quite a brood. All right. Well, this was delightful, as always. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you.
It has been very fun, and it's great to know that there are people out there listening along with us. So until next time, I'm Erica.
I'm Lisa.
And thank you once again for joining us on this epic journey. Saga of Rereading Epics is a proud part of the Incomparable Podcast Network. Visit theincomparable.com for more geeky podcasts. And while you're there, you can become a member, support the show, and get future episodes of this podcast right now.